Good morning to you all, and thank you for joining us at this first breakfast seminar sponsored by the Kuwait Programme at the London School of Economics and funded by KFAS from Kuwait. My name is David Held. I'm the director of the Centre for the Study of Global Governance at the LSE, run some time ago by Meghnad Desai and now by me. I'm also director of the new Kuwait program that has been at the LSE for about a year. The program's official name is the Kuwait Program on Development, Governance, and Globalization in the Gulf States. It was set up a year ago by a very generous grant from the Kuwait, from the KFAS, the Kuwait Foundation for the Advancement of Sciences. And I would like to take this moment to acknowledge KFAS's contribution, not just as the grant giver, as it were, but the very sympathetic way they are managing their relationship between KFAS and the LSE. They are bringing academics on board, tolerant to our ways and interests, but forming a very sustained dialogue between the London School of Economics, researchers here in the UK and in Europe, and researchers and academics and others and policymakers in the Gulf States. We're at the beginning of a very 10-year program, and we have a website already, which is very active, publishing research that we're undertaking. And over the next 2 to 3 years, there will be many major research papers published on our website and in different formats as well. There are seminar series, public lecture series, breakfast series, and so on. There'll be more events than most of us will be able to attend. But all of this is under the stimulus of KFAS, and we're extremely grateful to them for honoring the LSE in this way. Now, this morning, we have two economists. You know all the jokes about how many economists does it take to change a light bulb, but we have two economists speaking to the theme, a very important theme, the global economy in the Gulf States. They have not conferred with each other. They are both speaking to exactly the same topic, so it would be extremely interesting to compare and contrast, as it is, the things that they say. Neither of them really needs introduction from me, but suffice it to say, they are shining stars in the LSE skies, both of them. Tim Besley here to my left and Danny Kwa to my right. Tim Besley is the Kuwait Professor of Economics and Political Science at the LSE, where he's also Director of STICKED, a very a serious research outfit at the school. And of course, since September 2006, Tim Besley has been appointed by Gordon Brown to be the external member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee. And Danny Kwa is now head of economics at the LSE, and has served on the academic panels of the HM Treasury and the Office of National Statistics. But this is just the tip of their icebergs, as it were. Both are enormously productive economists. Both are renowned in the UK and beyond the UK shores. We are very proud to have them at the LSE, and I'm most looking forward to their presentations this morning. So please enjoy your breakfast. Both will speak for about 12 to 15 minutes at the most, and then, of course, we will open up for discussion, aware that most of you need to be away within the hour. So, Tim.
Thank you very much, David. I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to participate in this discussion. Since last summer, I've been proud to hold the title of Kuwait Professor of Economics and Political Science, thanks to the generous donation from KFAS. However, to be clear, this title is not meant to reflect any special expertise I have in studying the Gulf region, although it's quite natural that I've begun to take an interest in the issues and challenges faced in that region. But these days, I divide my time mainly between, as David mentioned, the Bank of England, where my brief is quite practical, and the LSE, where I'm furthering my research program in the broad areas of political economy, of the global economy. But in many ways, those three components of my life have come together recently, given the major challenge that the global economy is facing from rising oil prices, which has, as many of you know, moved very close to $140 a barrel only last week. And I haven't checked what happened overnight. It's possible they've moved significantly even since. Now, of course, there's much debate about whether or not that move in oil prices is driven by speculation or by fundamentals. It comes against the backdrop, as you know, of a significantly strong period of global growth, especially in the emerging market economies. Now, I certainly don't know whether over the coming months that price will continue to rise or fall. I'm also suspicious of those who express a strongly held conviction in either direction. There are certainly fundamentals at work, and if you look at the amount of oil now consumed by economies such as India or China, which together account for around 12% of global oil demand at this point, there are good reasons to think that some of the fundamental pressures out there will be maintained into the future. Now, I want to emphasize a number of consequences of this, both for the globe and for the Gulf states, and raise a few issues that I think will usefully be taken up in discussion. Now, one thing to emphasize is there actually is a distinct human angle on the rise in prices, which affect ordinary people, especially the poor around the globe. Recent moves in both energy and food prices are a major source of global redistribution across countries. And together, actually, they dwarf pretty much any kind of organized official source of transfers, such as official aid flows, across countries in the world. These are very major amounts of redistribution across country borders. Now, it goes without saying that as energy prices rise, oil importing economies will have to adjust to the lower living standards that this implies. There will also have to be adjustments on the production side. And over the medium term, we're likely to see a renewed interest in alternative sources of energy, increased energy efficiency. But equally, there's a challenge to the public finances in a number of countries. Some countries, such as the UK, tax oil. Others subsidize fuel. And they're going to face particularly difficult political pressures as they try to reduce their commitment to fuel subsidies, which could have significant repercussions, political repercussions in those countries. When it comes to thinking about the Gulf region itself, when we sit here in London, it would be tempting to think that a large windfall gain from the boom to a major export is an unabashed blessing. But I'm reminded of a story told to me by a good friend of mine who was brought up in a Marxist household in the 1950s, where there would be periodic gatherings of like-minded individuals to debate the big challenges of socialism, which they assumed was coming in all parts of the globe. And one topic that repeatedly came up was the topic of how they would deal with the problem of abundance under socialism, which they viewed as a distinct difficulty rather than as a blessing. Now, in some ways, you might think that the problem of abundance ought to be the debate that's now going on within the Gulf states. After all, they are the at least first-order beneficiaries from some of the increasing oil price rises. But I'm sure our colleagues from the Middle East will remind us that every silver lining is surrounded by a cloud. And applying that logic to the oil-producing states, of course, there's a long-run issue for the states in how to avoid the so-called resource curse, the observation that countries that are endowed with natural resources have over human history tended on the whole to be countries that are both poorer and declining in a longer-run perspective. Now, one of the earliest examples of the resource curse was, of course, the decline of the Spanish Empire. In a more contemporary setting, Sachs and Warner have showed in some very provocative work that there's a very strong and robust negative correlation in the modern world between being a resource-abundant country and income per capita. On the whole, resource-abundant countries are poorer, not richer. An interesting work by my colleague Guy Michaels at the LSE has shown that this logic can even be applied within countries. He looks at the state of Texas and the parts of the state of Texas where oil was discovered and compares it with the other parts. And the parts of Texas that have had oil actually grew more slowly than the other parts of Texas. So even within a smaller geographic unit, there seems to be some evidence that there's a serious challenge to be faced by being abundant in natural resources. So high natural resources distort short-term productive efforts towards resource extractive industries. In general, the technologies needed in such industries have moved more slowly than those in either manufacturing or high-end services. Providing an investment and business climate to encourage firms with capabilities to compete in global markets in services and manufacturing requires a a program of public and private investments, which are harder to generate when market price signals are directing resources towards the natural resource sector. One notable feature of the Gulf States at present in the GCC is a broad commitment to development through a market economy. But oil prices may be sending a market signal that will actually create a headwind for longer-term development strategies. Policies of building up the scientific base and fostering improved technology in non-resource-based industries makes a huge amount of sense. And the work that's been undertaken in the research program that David was describing later will, we hope, contribute to the debate about the best way to develop such initiatives and to foster long-term diversification of the Gulf economies. Now, of course, the Gulf states do begin in an advantageous position with investment in the terms of having resources to invest. But creating effective public institutions to ensure that good political incentives are in place to lean against market pressures is notoriously difficult. And we have to be honest about the bigger picture observation that the majority of countries in human history that have tried to pursue strategies to lean against market short-term market forces have been singly unsuccessful in delivering. And therein lies the major challenge of political economy for the Gulf states, to design effective public institutions to manage the resources to secure a long-term development strategy. And that's by no means a trivial attainment. Let me also talk a little bit about how to deal with the current account surpluses created by oil. Obviously, they generate domestic policy challenges, especially in a world where a country has pegged its exchange rate to the dollar, as have most of the Gulf states chosen to do. Sovereign wealth funds, therefore, are playing a major role in the allocation of world capital. They represent, they've played a role more recently, for example, in recapitalizing the banking system since last summer, the global banking system. But when we look at the operation of sovereign funds, it serves as a reminder that we still live in a world where capital surpluses flow by and large towards advanced economies. So the investment opportunities created to the Gulf state tend to flow in the direction of advanced economies. Now, that's been a source over the last 7 or 8 years of a major global imbalance, not just in the case of the Gulf states, but more generally. And one diagnosis of the recent problems in global capital markets actually sees that as part of the issue. In the absence of global investment opportunities in countries generating current account surpluses, more and more funds were channeled on a global basis into property markets in places like the UK and the US, funding current account deficits, driving up property prices, and compressing risk premia. This was due to low capital absorption potential in countries generating global savings, and that would include China, and also the absence of effective investment opportunities in parts of the world which are capital poor, such as Africa and South Asia. And in many ways, the recent turbulence in global financial markets was a response to a deleveraging that's had to take place because risk has been repriced in that process of global capital flows. And if you want to call it the institutional imbalances across the globe that have supported this, while there may be some immediate repricing of risk, show absolutely no evidence of resolving themselves. That if one says, why is it that large parts of the globe are unable, in spite of being capital poor, to generate effective investment opportunities, it's down to the weak institutions, both political and market-based institutions, to support investment in parts of the world where more than a billion of people are living on less than a dollar a day. And of course, those same people at the moment are suffering as a consequence of the rise in oil prices. So there's a serious challenge still out there to do with what I would call a fundamental institutional imbalance in the global economy, the way in which that is driving and will continue to drive the allocation of global resources across country borders. So to sum up, and hopefully I've said some stuff that will provoke some discussion, I suppose whether you're in a consuming nation as we are here, a net consuming nation, although of course we have some production here, or a net producing nation, I suppose the watchword is going to be, or remains, diversification. Consumers are looking for ways to wean themselves away from oil dependence. But for them, current price signals are creating just such an incentive. I think diversification for producers is paradoxically much harder right now, because the market signals are sending exactly the opposite signal within those countries as to where scarce resources should be allocated. They're to reinforce the ability of those natural resource sectors to work. In that case, I think the challenge of the Gulf states is going to be to maintain some kind of long-run effective path in the face of what are going to be short-term headwinds.
Okay. Thanks, Tim. As David has pointed out, although Tim and I did not collude on what we're going to talk about, as it turns out, because we are looking at the global economy, and because we are looking at the Gulf states, necessarily the things that we will be discussing touch on each other. I will bring up again some of the same issues that Tim has already done, but forgive me for using a PowerPoint presentation this morning. There are some numbers and pieces of evidence I would like to bring into the discussion to shed light on some of these issues. I'm a macroeconomist. I study global growth and global inequality. In days when I have delusions of grandeur, I think that the things I study are the kinds of economic activity that if you go into outer space and look down on the Earth, you can still discern. So I'm interested in the shifting global imbalances, whether it's international trade relations or the number of people being lifted out of poverty or the sovereign wealth funds that are accumulating and being deployed in different parts of the globe. It seems to me there are three principal actors right now in the global economy, either active or passive, but they are all important. The United States is obviously one. I want to argue that its significance in the global arena and how this picture will evolve from here on is diminishing, and it's diminishing for the reason that Asia is rising and the Gulf states similarly, that oil will continue to be a hugely important resource, and sovereign wealth funds for both the Asian economies and the Gulf states will play an ever larger role, much, much larger than they currently do. Against these actors, the actions and the consequences that will emerge have to do with climate change, have to do with the evolution of how we use food and fuels, and have to do with how, as a world society, we tackle the problem of global poverty. Now, these are admittedly huge issues, and in the 12 minutes that I have, I can focus on only one small aspect, but I think the critical aspect, and that is the global imbalance and the appropriate policy actions that, as a global polity, we need to think about. The conclusions that I'm going to drive us towards, well, they're not concrete conclusions, but I hope that they give you a picture of an understanding of global dynamics. Okay, I'm going to try and bring forward the idea that there's a shifting global center of gravity, that the international tensions that have emerged now have to do with trade imbalance, to some degree trade and inequality, although I won't have time to talk very much about that. And certainly, for the last 2 years, for the last 6 months, food, fuel, and natural resources. I want to argue that all of these point towards a reality that says there's a single source for the trade imbalance. And the sooner we recognize what that single source is, the better we will get at fixing these global problems. I want to be clear that, as a whole, world well-being has improved dramatically from the fact of growth in Asia. And any policy actions, any discussions that we have that does not take that explicitly into account will simply miss an important part of what we're here to do today, to make the world a better place. And I want, thirdly, to argue that the resource-rich economies, the Gulf states and others, have a critical and central role to play in this unwinding. Okay. Tim has already referred to, although he did not use these words explicitly, what some policymakers and some economists call the global savings glut. Now, this is the idea that some parts of the world have generated so much savings, there's been so much capital released on world capital markets. In this mad dash for yield, they have driven down interest rates worldwide. They have led U.S. investors to chase ever riskier, but then ignoring the risk, ever riskier prospects. And implicit in that discussion about the global savings glut is that accounts for a large part of the mortgage, subprime, crisis that and credit crunch that we're currently in. So let's unpack that fact a little bit. Since global savings somewhere in the world always matches global excess consumption somewhere in the world, it is difficult to place our finger on who it is that's responsible for this global flood of capital. And it's at first difficult to try and then unpack what solutions we might offer for this. So to be clear about the facts, this figure, the details are such that, you know, if I were to write them down in a paper and give you figures and numbers, there would be just a reeling off of them, and the magnitudes might then, you know, just a bit overwhelm us. It seems to me that graphics, very simple graphics, carry the point quite dramatically. The blue line that you see in this picture is the evolution of the U.S. trade balance. The fact that it's moving southwards, the fact that it's moving downwards in this picture, shows the looming trade imbalance, the looming trade deficit that the United States has been running, well, gosh, over the last 20 years. In about 1990 was the last time the United States achieved a trade balance. And then since then, that trade balance line has just gone southwards. It's just gone through the floor. This has not happened everywhere else in the world. The yellow line in this picture shows what happened to the European Union, a similarly developed, similarly wealthy part of the world. It showed no similar deep decline into trade deficit area. To be clear about the magnitudes, the United States has, you know, recently, in about 2006, was running a trade deficit of $900 billion a year. That's a little bit over 8% of GDP. $900 billion a year is larger than the gross domestic product of India. So put that another way, the United States each year was eating more than it was making one Indian economy. This is obviously a situation that could not be sustained, but the flip side of this is that somewhere else in the world, somebody is running an Indian economy-sized trade surplus. Now, who might that be? Well, many policymakers, some economists, point to how it is emerging China with the mispriced currency, with low-wage labor, responsible for this global savings glut, on the X side of it, the looming trade deficit. Well, actually, if you map China's global trade surplus, it does not even show up at all different from the horizontal axis. It was basically zero throughout this entire period. As you look around the world, until very, very recently, until after 2005, as you look around the world, the group of countries that showed a significant trade surplus, that showed significant savings glut, if you want to call it, to balance the United States, was basically the group of oil-exporting countries. From as long ago as 1990, the oil-exporting countries were the ones running the matching current account trade surplus against the United States. But of course, you know, looking at these trade numbers overall does not tell us who is generating the trade surplus, who is generating the race for yield, who is responsible for the world that we live in now in financial markets. And indeed, when you look at the bilateral trade balance, where the United States trades with China, and then we'll look in a second at where the United States trades with the oil exporting countries and with the Gulf states and so on, as we take a tour around the world, sure enough, the United States does show this bilateral trade deficit against China. And it does seem like if there is a culprit here, it could well be the Chinese economy, Chinese consumers, who are not simply doing the job consuming, who are generating this trade surplus, who are generating this race for yield. When you put in this same picture the bilateral U.S. trade balance against the European Union and the oil exporters, well, actually, they show pretty much the same dynamic pattern. The United States was running a bilateral trade deficit, not just against China, but against, well, pretty much everybody else in the world, against the European Union and against the oil exporters. And when you group the European Union and oil exporters together, two very heterogeneous, different groups of economies reacting to very different price signals, reacting to very different structural conditions, the trade deficit that the United States was running against the European Union and the oil exporting countries combined almost exactly moves step for step with the bilateral trade deficit against China. Now, this configuration of spatial and dynamic correlation suggests to me that the United States was the economy from which the impetus, the originating shock, in vector regressions we like to talk about shocks that then propagate through the system. It was the United States economy, its consumers and producers that were generating the initial impetus for the global savings glut, which in turn was simply passively reacting. And both the savings glut and the U.S. subprime mortgage crisis was actually due to shocks in the U.S. economy. Okay. But there's more to this story, and this is the story that you and I want to try and unpack. The oil exporters here were by far the dominant surplus economy, set of economies. Okay. It seems to me from this little tour that we've taken around the world, we need to be looking for U.S.-specific explanations for the initial impetus to why there was a global savings glut, to why there was this subsequent race for yield and cheap capital. In terms of contributions to the world, I want now to turn to contributions to the world. I want now to turn to food and fuel in particular. In terms of contributions to the world, the United States, if it was the original shock country for generating the global savings glut, for generating financial imbalances internationally, the United States is actually no longer such a major player in terms of real goods and services generated in the world. Okay. This little table shows you that it's true that in 2005, the U.S. generated almost a third of world gross domestic product. Countries like China and India were far, far smaller, no more than one-fifth the size of the United States. And the Gulf countries, similarly, small as well. But when you look at the second column, the countries that are generating growth in the world economy now are these much smaller economies. China and India, which together are less than one-quarter the size of the United States, measured in market exchange rates, generated growth for the contributions to growth in the world economy almost exactly the same magnitude as the United States. When you add in the Gulf countries as well, they more than match the U.S. economy. So we see a picture that's developing for how the global economy has evolved in the last 15, 20 years, of the United States having been an impetus in this accounting of the spatial and temporal correlations, of the United States being an impetus for financial imbalances in the world, and at the same time, the other countries picking up the slack, as it were, in terms of producing real goods and services. Where does this take us? Well, I want eventually to get to discussions about global poverty, but the picture that we've now built of how the U.S., the global economy hangs together is in jeopardy of being overturned by the dramatic changes that we've seen in food and fuel prices. So just to be clear about the magnitudes, the details here don't really matter. But the price of rice, a staple of a large part of the world's population, has risen fourfold in the last 5 years. Similarly, the price of oil, you know, they've both doubled in the last year alone. Nothing in the world grows as rapidly. Nothing in the real world of goods and services grows as rapidly as we've observed for food and oil. What is happening here? Well, what's happening here is what I think, what I like to think Arjun Murthy describing in terms of the possibility of our racing towards $200 per barrel oil. Arjun Murthy, you'll remember, was the Goldman Sachs analyst who first predicted $100 a barrel oil when the price of oil was everyone thought calmly sitting at $50. But the fact is that now the world has changed because we try to take into account ethanol and biofuels because world agricultural production has changed, that in the United States we now power SUVs using inefficiently produced biofuels. We're now in a state of the world where Don Kennedy, formerly the president of Stanford University, calls a world where cars now compete with people for food. And the lines between food and fuel are beginning to vanish in world commodity markets. The imbalance that exists now in the world sits closely to what's happening to food and fuels. There's a huge demand for fuels from Asia, even larger possibly than what Tim has already suggested to you, partly because the Asian economies are not simply growing so quickly, are not simply holding up their side of global growth. But fuel is heavily subsidized in Asia. It is inefficiently used in Asia. Asian economies produce a unit of GDP using between 2 to 3 times what Western economies do in terms of energy. Asian economies produce 11% of the world's oil and consume 22% of it. It is subsidized everywhere massively. India, which has for many years suffered huge current account imbalance, maybe not as large as the United States, but importing much, much more than it exports, now imports all of the oil it uses. It is growing now at 8% a year. 33% of its current import bill is oil alone. With a quadrupling of oil prices, that current account deficit is just going to explode sky high. The Middle East, including the Gulf states, are profligate. It's profligate in how it uses fuel. Because, like in many other parts of the world, when a country produces something, many of its citizens feel that it should be able to use that something cheaply. Subsidies in the Middle East now have led to what Arjun Murthy described to me and has documented, a situation where the Middle East consumes as much oil as all of China. The Middle East has maybe, what, 1/25th, 1/30th of the population of China. It consumes as much oil as China now. It's the only part of the world where oil consumption is growing as rapidly as China. So we see, although this doesn't show up in global, internationally traded markets, we see oil consumption rising dramatically in parts of the world that are holding the world economy afloat, that are picking up where the United States has not been able to sustain. The huge danger in all of this is that that part of the world is also the part of the world that has seen most good generated in terms of human welfare. The world has lifted about 500 million people out of a dollar a day poverty in the last 25 years. China has lifted 500 million people out of a dollar a day poverty in the world in the last 25 years. Everybody who has been lifted out of poverty in the last 25 years is Chinese, basically. Okay, not factually strictly correct, but that's a good way to try and remember it vividly. So we see a situation where the large forces in the global economy are leading to this collision between a part of the world that's generating the greatest good in terms of human welfare, is holding up the global economy in its growth, has been subject to political and international economic animosity somewhat in terms of possibly being the culprit of the global savings glut. And the reality is a little bit more nuanced, as I've tried to suggest. The huge battle now in terms of fuel and food and how we tackle climate change, merging these lines between these commodities, and how we treat the problem of global poverty. These are massive problems for which the oil and resource-rich economies in the Gulf states and elsewhere will have a huge role to play. Thank you.